the paper.
Welcome to episode 112 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. You can also find the show notes for this episode at HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast. Today, I'm talking with Therese Zemlin, who has worked in a range of media, including paper, welded steel, light, digital media, and natural materials. Her work ranges from small sculpture to installation and is inspired by elements and phenomena of the ever-changing natural world. She has exhibited her work nationally and has received numerous grants, including a Southern Arts Federation National Endowment for the Arts Regional Fellowship and a Pollock Krasner Foundation grant. After earning a BFA from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and an MFA from the University of Texas at Austin, Zemlin taught fibers and sculpture at the University of South Carolina, Columbia, Appalachian State University in North Carolina, and Phillips Academy, Andover. She currently divides her time between St. Paul and the North Woods of Minnesota. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Therese Zemlin, welcome to Paper Talk. Happy to chat with you, and tell me where you're, where we're speaking to you from.
Well, I am down in my studio in St. Paul. We moved from Andover, Massachusetts to St. Paul in 2020 when we retired. My husband taught at the museum school in Boston.
Okay.
And so we bought a, for retired people, you know, we bought a big house.
Oh.
And the reason for that was so we'd have studio space at home. And so I'm down, it's a walkout basement, and I've got a nice view of our gardens, and I've got a fireplace, and it's a small studio, but, you know, we had a huge studio in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and I found that I mainly worked in one corner of it.
Ah.
In all the space. And
smaller space.
Yeah, I sort of took over this one corner, and I thought, well, so I sort of recreated that corner. And in St. Paul. So that's where we're at now. And then actually in a few days, we're going to go up to, we have a cabin up north of Duluth, Minnesota.
Oh.
And so I have an even smaller corner up there to work. And then if I want to work big, we've got a big garage up there. But we'll be up there. It's on a little lake. Oh. And so we'll be back and forth for the summer.
Okay. Now, is your husband an artist also?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. He's a printmaker.
Okay.
And he actually is working now. He does a lot of his work at High Point Center for the Print or Center for Prints in Minneapolis. But he's also got a home studio. So he does most of his carving of blocks and stuff at home. Okay. And then he goes to High Point to print. Yeah, but he taught printmaking for many years at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston.
Right. Okay, great. Well, let's back up and just talk a little bit about childhood, where you grew up and went to school and any artistic influences along that path.
Well, I grew up in, my parents are both from Two Harbors, Minnesota, which is very close to where the family cabin is that we now have. And my father was on the faculty in the speech and hearing department at the University of Illinois. And so he ran an anatomy lab there. And then my mother was a speech therapist. And so because they were academics, they were able to spend school years in Champaign-Urbana. And then we spent our summers up in Minnesota.
Oh, right.
And I think I have spent every summer but one up there my entire life.
Wow.
The age of four. I've spent every summer up there. And on the one hand, it kept me from, you know, I probably should have been going to some conferences and, you know, doing that kind of stuff. So I think it kind of kept me out of the loop, you know, career-wise, maybe a little more than it should have. But it also gave me an opportunity to I really knew my grandparents and even my great grandmother. And so it was an opportunity to stay strongly connected to family and also to just roots, you know, in a geographic place as well. And I always made art up there too. I had, you know, I had a welding set up in my dad's garage. He had a sawmill. So I had a welding set up at the sawmill. And, you know, so I was able to get quite a bit of work done up there as well. So, so summers in Minnesota, school year in Champaign-Urbana, and I went to college there as well. Okay. I think a big, I think my mother used to recount that in my first grade report card, the main comment that she remembered and that she would remind me of every now and then was the comment that Teresa is a very smart little girl, but she spends too much time looking out the window. And I thought, well, yeah. So I think that speaks to the sort of artistic side of me, you know, paying attention to, but maybe not paying attention to what I'm supposed to be paying attention to, but definitely paying attention.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that kind of sensibility. And in college, I changed majors a lot and I didn't like college and I was going to drop out. And I was at that time, I was a weaver. And so I took a weaving class, evening class at Parkland College in Champaign when I was still in high school. And really liked it and wound up apprenticing to the woman who taught the class for a number of months. And my parents were extremely supportive and they bought me a couple of floor looms and got me set up with my initial inventory of yarn and stuff. And I started cranking out, you know, the usual, you know, throws and pillows and vests and jackets and that kind of stuff, and started going to art fairs and selling. And I think that sort of intense making and intense kind of production making still finds its way into my work. It's still there, still that kind of production sort of aspect. And then while I was doing that, I was majoring in biology, and then I majored in anthropology, and then I was going to major in English. And there was a craft sale at the University of Illinois that was run by the art department. And I wound up getting involved in that. And I went to the first meeting for the craft sale. And I looked around and there were just all these potters and glass blowers and, you know, artists. And I looked around and I thought, these are my people. I have found my people.
Did you not know really that you could study art? Or I'm just curious why you didn't find them before, since you had done the weaving in high school.
Yeah. I think that perhaps I had this naive idea that somehow any major but art would be more practical than art. And then my very best friend, lifelong best friend, and we're still very close. When she majored in art, that was the permission I needed to be able to major. So I was majoring in anthropology because I could learn about making. I thought, well, this will be more practical. Well, actually, anthropology is not even art. So when I figured all that out, then I just changed my major to art. I changed very late. I had to take an extra year, you know, for college. But it was totally worth it. So I majored in sculpture and then did some scientific illustration for my father. Lived off the grid at, you know, another little cabin that we had up north for a while. And I was going to spend the winter there. And I lasted until mid-September and decided to move to Minneapolis.
And was it too isolated?
It was really isolated. Yeah. I mean, this was in 1981. No phone, no cell phone. Hard to get together with friends because I had no phone. And I would go and deliver groceries to my grandmother once a week, and I'd go up to her apartment and she would say, "Therese, what are you doing living in the woods? You know, you're not meeting any men, you know." And I'd be driving home in my pickup truck back to the cabin off the grid thinking, "I'm not meeting any men."
Funny.
But I mean, it was more than that, but that was just, you know, kind of where things were going. So I moved to Minneapolis. Okay. And that's actually where I met John. we both worked at an art, at a bar called the Artist Quarter, which was close to the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. So so we were there for a couple of years, and then you know, got married, and John wanted to go to grad school in Texas, so we moved to Texas. And by the time we were through with 5 years in Texas, I had my MFA and he didn't. So then we moved back to Champaign because my parents were gone and their house was empty. And John got into the U of I, which is a really good school too. Mm-hmm. So he got his degree in printmaking at the University of Illinois. He worked with Dan Soha. And while he was doing that, actually, in, if I can back up a little bit, in undergraduate school, I worked kind of informally with Frank Gallo. He taught me some things about hand paper making because I wanted to use paper in my work. And then when we moved back to Champaign in 1986, 87, for John to go to grad school, I wound up working for Frank Gallo at Editions and Cast Paper and was there for, oh gosh, at least three. I was there for 3 years at least. And actually, I had taken over Rick Hungerford's position there as sort of the pulp colorist. And so, while I was working there, I mean, I learned so much about hand paper making, not just the coloring, but about paper making just in general. And then I had access to all these supplies and all these equipment and any waste material that we had, you know, I brought it all to my studio, you know, was working with all this, like how many paper makers, you know, have the problem of over a weekend. It's like, what am I going to do with 25 pounds of liner? It helped. You know, pulp and linen. So,
Can we take a step back? I want to know what you got your MFA in and how you said that you wanted to learn about paper and that's how you met Frank Gallo.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I sort of skipped over that. In undergraduate school, at the U of I, University of Illinois, I can't even remember what I guess maybe I had seen Frank's cast paper. It was kind of a big thing at that time. And a lot of artists in the 70s, late 70s, were moving away from things like epoxy because they were so dangerous. And Frank was one of those people. You know, he had worked in epoxy. And I actually worked in epoxy with him for a while before I started doing paper at Editions and Cast Paper. And I actually got I'm pretty sure I had liver poisoning. Wasn't terrible, but it took a few years to go away. So a lot of artists in the 70s were switching to paper as a material that was much safer to work with. And I also, just in terms of sensibilities, I liked the material as well. And I had been doing some low relief castings in bronze, and I was curious to try taking, you know, those same molds, the plaster molds that I'd used to make my waxes, taking those same molds and just trying to cast paper in them. I was also doing some glass casting. I was just trying to casting in all different materials. And so Frank got me going with the paper, and that appealed to me. It was accessible. The pieces, when they were done, they didn't weigh a lot. And there's something about that kind of fiber sensibility that was not unsimilar to the weaving, as well. So that was working with Frank with the paper, and then I continued working in paper in grad school. I used it as a covering, sort of a skin for the welded wire armatures I was making. I would say in grad school, I didn't really learn a lot about paper making in grad school. I was kind of on my own with that. So I didn't really learn more about, and I didn't have access to equipment, you know. So the paper making sort of, I think that the work evolved in terms of form and structure and content, but the paper technical part of the paper making did not really evolve.
And you were studying sculpture in Texas?
Yes, I was studying sculpture. I started out at UT San Antonio just because that's where my husband wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And we had friends in San Antonio, and there was just a lot going on there. Mm-hmm. And I didn't care for the program. And mm-hmm. so I was offered a really nice position at UT Austin.
Oh, okay.
Which is a better school. Uh-huh. Anyway. And so we moved to Austin and I got my MFA there. And then we moved back to San Antonio and I continued working there with really cheap studio space. The Blue Star Art Space was just starting up.
Oh, yeah.
And it was at that point, it was really rough and raw and cheap. And uh-huh. So we were there. Our friend, Gary Shafter, was running a gallery upstairs from us. And then my husband and another friend were running a film, sort of an alternative film club next door to our studio. So we did that for a few years. And, you know,
was the Southwest Craft Center there yet or not?
Yeah.
Beck Whitehead.
The Southwest. Susan. I know that Beck Whitehead and Susan Dolan mm-hmm. were there. I was not involved mm-hmm. with the Craft Center. So okay. Now that you mention it, it's like, I really should know. It's a really important place. And I did teach, I think I taught a workshop or two there and I've been mm-hmm. in some shows there. But now that you mention it, I don't really have a strong
recollection. It might have started a few years later.
Yeah. Yeah. This would have been in the mid 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right. I'm not sure of the timing myself.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But yeah, I wasn't involved with the Craft Center. So.
Okay, so talk a little bit about these sculptures you were making. So you were making welded armatures and they were covering them with paper. You were forming sheets. What kind of pulp?
Yeah, I was using, I was making steel armatures essentially. Out of quarter-inch pencil steel and working with just very organic kinds of forms. And I was kind of interested in the idea of kind of the built world, architectural built world sort of combined mm-hmm. with natural form. So kind mm-hmm. of combining the built and the natural together, which when you're building something happens automatically anyway, because even if you are working with, you know, organic forms from nature, you're still building the thing.
Mm-hmm,
so right. There's still that kind of element of architecture there. So I was making work that was, it was probably about, I don't know, 6 feet tall, maybe 2 or 3 feet in diameter, kind of figurative in proportion.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually started out covering them in cement and they were heavy.
Yeah.
They could go outside. That was one advantage of them. They could go outside. And those, they were really architectural. And at that point, I was also influenced by all of the sort of the cement work in San Antonio. The kind of, there'd be, you know, you'd go to a bus stop in San Antonio and there, you know, part of it would be this sort of ornamental sculpted cement.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, I think it's sort of a Hispanic mm-hmm. you know, kind of tradition. I didn't learn more about it at the time. I should have, but I was influenced by that, I think. And just mm-hmm. all the adobe. And so there was okay. that sort of sensibility in San Antonio that I was attracted to. But after working in cement for a while, and then the pieces really were intended to be inside just in terms of their proportion and I don't know, a certain kind of intimacy. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, if they're going to be inside, there's no reason to make them out of cement. Mm-hmm. So then I started working in paper and started out sort of trying to get the paper to kind of look like cement and then gradually just let the paper be paper. And the more, and I was making the steel armatures and then I was covering them in expanded lath, which is for cement work, you know, concrete okay. or plaster work. So I was covering them in expanded lath and the lath was really nice because since it's expanded, you can sculpt it. You can, you know, you can grab hold of it and squish it back down or you can stretch it out. So you could actually do compound curves with it in a way that you couldn't do with something like window screen or a welded, welded screen. And then the more I worked with the paper, the thinner I got the paper, even though I didn't have any equipment, I was just using cotton linter.
And were you just using pulp that you were casting, or were you pulling sheets?
I was pouring it.
Pouring it, yeah.
Yeah, so I was pouring the pulp on. And I don't remember now if I was, I think maybe I was dyeing it with fabric dyes. I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe, you know, some paint afterwards. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, and Therese has a great website with documentation of her whole history of work. So listeners, you can go look. We'll put a link to these specific genres that we're talking about.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
So there was the large welded steel paint pieces. And I did those for quite a while. I worked large and with the pencil steel and the lath and paper up until about 1995, 1984, 95,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe a little before that. But they changed quite a bit. I learned so much at Editions and Cast Paper that, you know, I started working with brighter colors. I started working more with, you know, experimenting with abaca and overbeaten abaca and, you know, different kinds of materials. And sometimes just whatever was on the verge of going bad in the shop that we could use for for editioning. And I take it home, you know, take it back to my studio. I had an old ice cream plant that I worked in downtown Champaign. And I would take it there and figure out what to do with it. So.
Oh, cool. Tell me a little more about Editions and Cast Paper, because I don't really know that much about Frank and that studio. So did artists come in and you guys fabricated their work with them?
We were actually doing work for Circle Galleries in Chicago.
Okay.
And so we were doing editions for, we were editioning Frank's work, low relief castings. And then also pieces, they were low relief castings, but they were also kind of pulp painting. It was sort of pulp painting and casting kind of both at the same time, because they were extremely low relief. But we were doing work for Yakov Agam, and that's the artist that comes to mind.
Yeah. Okay.
We were doing work for other artists, a lot of sort of op art kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. So where the color was, you know, we'd send stuff off to, you know, for approval and get it back, and they wanted bluer. And it's like, oh my God. And I had put so much pigment in the paper. Right. I would tell Frank, I was like, Frank, this isn't paper anymore. It's pastels with some fiber in it.
Yeah. <You know?
laughs> So it was additioning for Circle Galleries.
Okay.
And then in 1989, it was right around Christmas. The economy was doing very badly. And a sort of feature article in Time magazine was that Sotheby's could not even sell an Andy Warhol. And the next week, we were all laid off. There was just nothing. And my husband worked there, too. So we were both laid off.
Right.
And in a way, you know, it's one of those things that was actually a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could have kept working at Editions. You know, it was fine. You know,
yeah.
I could have kept working there, but we both lost our jobs there. And then it was job hunting season at the academic, in the academic sphere. So we both started looking for teaching jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we were hoping one of us would get one, and we both got teaching jobs, which is good. The bad is that they were far apart. So, we had to split up, you know, live in different places for a while. So John was in Chicago at the Art Institute. And then I was running the graduate and undergraduate fiber program at the University of South Carolina.
Okay.
So I was there for 4 years. And, you know, I really liked Columbia, South Carolina. I didn't like the weather, and I didn't like that it was so far from home.
Mm-hmm.
But the people there were just so wonderful. And the art scene there, there was so much support for the arts in the Southeast, and, you know, in general, in Columbia and, you know, in Atlanta. And I just had so much stuff going on. It was regional. It was all regional stuff, but it was a really good experience.
Yeah. And so what was your work? What was happening with your work then?
I was still doing the large scale, welded steel and paper. And there was a paper, there was a beater in the paper facility. Oh. And then the sculpture facility was next door. And so I was able to do my welding there. So, I mean, I just kind of lived at school. I had a little apartment and I just sort of lived, just, I was at school all the time.
Yeah.
And, making work. And, you know, I wound up having a solo exhibition at the Mint Museum. And then also, you know, work featured at the South Carolina State Museum and, you know, other regional museums, and selling some work. And for a while there, I was showing more. I almost had too many shows. Like, I couldn't make enough work, mm-hmm. you know, fast enough mm-hmm. For all these venues. And there was also a lot going on in town, you know, getting my grad students opportunities to do installation for events and things like that. It was really good. I wound up going to North Carolina. I was having a really great time in South Carolina and not making any money. So I took a job in North Carolina at Appalachian State University,
uh-huh.
which was kind of a step down because it's a smaller school and it didn't have a grad program. But I don't know, it was up in the mountains and it just seemed like it would be, I was getting pretty burned out.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, maybe this will be a little slower pace. It seems like mm-hmm. it's kind of mellower, but of course you get into a new teaching job and it's not, you know, right. It's just as wacky in different ways as, you know, the previous one. I did get a lot of art made there, but I also discovered that I really don't like living in the mountains. I don't like the mountains.
Oh,
at least the mountains, at least the Appalachian mountains, it felt really isolated, really mm-hmm. isolating.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm more of a great, you know, a big sky, you know, cornfield water
uh-huh.
person than mountains, but it was good to be there for a while.
And what department were you in there?
I was in the fiber area.
Okay.
Fiber. I wound up doing some sculpt. I think I taught some sculpture too. Fiber and sculpture in the art department at Appalachian State.
And was there any paper there?
I actually got a beater. By the time I left, there was paper there. Yeah, there wasn't when I got there, uh-huh. but I set up. I took over a little corner of the, was essentially a weaving studio. There was a corner of it that I was able to, I think maybe it had been used for dyeing, mm-hmm. for fabric dyeing, and I was able to kind of repurpose it for paper making as well. Oh. So.
Cool. And I know when people, you're not no longer there. Is the paper department still there? Sometimes it's just because of a professor, right?
I last I heard it was still there.
Uh-huh.
You know, I guess it's still, I don't know if it's still being, you know, used or not, but it's still there. Yeah, the beater is still there.
Right. And I think it was somewhere around this time that you got interested in these collapsible Japanese forms.
Yeah, I actually started those while I was at Appalachian State University. I was getting a little, I felt like the steel armatures and the paper pulp had kind of run its course.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, the steel was, I was working at cold, so physically it was demanding.
Mm.
And the way that I lashed the lath onto the steel armatures was also physically demanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in my late 30s and it was starting to really take its toll.
Right.
And as you know, when a physical therapist says, you can't do this anymore.
Oh, yeah.
No. So there was that, but it was kind of time to move on anyway. You know, digital cameras were kind of getting to be a thing, you know, scanners are getting even more of a thing.
Uh-huh.
It was getting easier to work digitally with imagery than it had been in the past. Inkjet printers were pretty interesting. The early ones were really nice to work with because the inks were so fugitive. You know, you could do all kinds of interesting transfers and stuff mm-hmm. that you can't do nowadays because the inks are so much better.
Uh-huh.
But actually, it was, I went to a paper book arts intensive, and I believe it was in
Penland,
was
right?
Penland.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the one that was at Penland. Yeah. And I took a workshop with Richard Flavin and Tim Barrett on doing the Japanese lantern stuff. Mm-hmm. And that just, you know, sometimes you go to a workshop, it's like, well, that's fine. That's interesting. That's mm-hmm. fine. That's interesting. And then you go to one, it's like, holy smokes, this is it.
Yeah. <You know>? Yeah.
And so, you know, I went back, you know, back to Appalachian State or in the summer as well. And, you know, I started making all kinds of foam core molds. And then I started, it's like, I don't like this foam core stuff. So I started making them out of plywood. And then at this point, I think I'd moved to Boston. I'd taken a leave of absence from Appalachian State, and I'd moved to Boston.
Because John was there.
John was in Boston. Yeah. Yeah. And we had been doing the long distance academic thing for almost 10 years. And right. I thought, and I did the thing you're never supposed to do. I just up and quit my tenure track job and moved to Boston, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you can't leave your life for a tenure track job, you know?
Right. Right. That makes sense.
So I took a leave first, mm-hmm. and then I actually did come back to Appalachian State for one more year. And then I resigned and mm-hmm. moved to Boston. But while I was in Boston, because John was at the museum school, I had access to all kinds of stuff. And the Boston, I'm going to get it wrong. I think it's the Boston Center for Architecture. I think it's the BCA. I think that's the name of it. Mm-hmm. Had just gotten their first laser cutter.
Mm.
And they invited museum school artists to essentially come and play.
Oh.
To see what it would do. And so I started making some Japanese lantern forms out of book board with a laser printer. And then kind of went back to making them in plywood and then started making them bigger.
We'll post some pictures of Teresa's work, but this armature is a really interesting collapsible form that you put together, and then you wind reed around, and then you apply paper to
right.
it. And coincidentally, I was living in New York City working at Dudonnet, and someone I knew went to that same paper and book intensive that you were at and came back to New York and knew I would be interested in this form. So she showed me how to make this collapsible lantern form, which I've been experimenting with ever since.
Oh yeah, you've done some great work with that. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I kept working with that form, and actually, when I was still in North Carolina, I had made some really large molds, which you know about that, with mm-hmm. a piece you did for the library, and then I put motors in them.
Talk a little bit about that, motors and air and sort of what you were thinking.
Yeah.
So since these forms are collapsible and expandable, you really utilize that. I mean, usually they're just sculptures that are static.
Right. They're sculptures that are static. But if you hold one in your hand, it's like a slinky. If you hold it in your hand, you can't just hold it in your hand.
Right.
You know, you have to squish it in and out, you mm-hmm. know, and play with it and see how much you can bend it. And, you know, so if you're holding it in your hand, that's what you're doing with it. And I thought, well, what if, would there be a way to get this, what happens when you hold it in your hand? Would there be a way to get that to happen when it's a sculpture that's hanging, you know, hanging from the ceiling or freestanding or free hanging? Mm-hmm. Would there be a way to get that? And I don't even remember why I even had any motors. I don't even remember how that happened, but uh-huh. I do remember it was kind of late one night and I had some kind of little motor. Maybe I'd bought it at Axeman Surplus in St. Paul. I guess I must've just had some motors around, and I got one of these motors and I somehow managed to epoxy a sort of like a tie rod kind of thing onto it. And somehow Jerry rigged it, just prototyping, you know, mm-hmm. somehow Jerry rigged it and got it into this lantern form. I put two of them together and I taped the connecting rod to one end of one and the other end of the other one. And I turned on the motor and it was like, huh, this is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
You know, things started kind of swimming, you know.
Yeah.
And so then I took it from there. And I have a brother who's a mechanical engineer. So, and again, this was pre-Zoom, pre-cell phones or anything. And so we'd have long phone conversations about how to get those to work. And then there was the, you know, getting things balanced. And there was one, you know, that kind of thing. It seems simple, but then once you get into it, it's pretty complicated.
But you're too far in to step back.
Right. Yeah. Right. So that was a difficult project. That was really difficult. But it was really rewarding too. And I have shown that piece a number of times. And there's a little bit of a Rube Goldberg element to it, because it's sort of, especially the forms that oscillate at a higher speed, they're kind of self-destructing. You know, even if they're up for a month, they're kind of self-destructing. And I had it up in Boston at a college near the museum school. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting that, I mean, like every week I'd go back when the gallery was closed, I'd sneak in and take it down and take it home and repair it and bring it back.
What, now is this Five Bodies that we're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So listeners will put a picture of Five Bodies.
Yeah, and there is a little tiny video of that, you know, on my website too. You can click on it and see how the pieces kind of move. And the pieces are bigger than what they look like. The larger pieces in that, they're like, I don't know, they're maybe 30 inches in diameter and 6 feet tall. So they're big. I think when people look at it, they assume that the smallest one is like the size of a coffee cup, but the smallest one is really, it's probably, I don't know, maybe 2 feet.
Wow.
Long.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's bigger than it looks.
Right. And I know you explored this technique quite a bit. Tell me a little about the bed project. And did that one involve inkjet or some kind of transferring of images?
Yeah, that was, you know, I think I printed all of the images for that one. I may have printed all those out on an old laser printer.
Okay.
Like an old office laser printer. I don't think I had an inkjet printer at that point. I may have. And all of the imagery for that, I think a lot of the imagery for that, it may have actually been scanned, done on a scanner and not on a, not with a camera, though I did have a digital camera at that point. I think in 2000, and no, I didn't get, in 2002, I know I had a digital camera. Yeah, I'm not sure now. Some of it was scanned, and some of it was done via camera for those pieces.
Right. But so these sculptures are another interesting aspect of the construction is that you create flat panels that then you apply onto the form so that you can print. So you do a lot of sort of figuring out, I'm sure, like how to print the most on a sheet of paper and how to,
Yeah, it's, you know, one thing that I hadn't mentioned that kind of brings up is, yeah, that's true. Yes, is figuring out sort of the flat pattern that's going to become three dimensional. And of course, then I also want the images to sort of match up, you know, all the way around as much as I can. So there was that, and the images are a spiral. And the structure is a spiral, so that kind of adds another element of getting how to get things to sort of match up as well.
Right.
And one thing I didn't mention was that while I was making a sculpture with the armatures back to graduate school and moving forward, I always made flat patterns. And I used to do a lot of sewing when I was in high school.
I was going to ask. Yeah.
I made a lot of my own clothes.
Right.
And I would actually get teased in a good way in graduate school, because I'd be working in the, you know, in the shop, and it was mostly guys who were in there building stuff. And I would come in and I would have my patterns all rolled up, and it was like sewing, you know, and I'd unroll my pattern just like I was going to make a dress.
Right.
you know, and those are the kinds of patterns that I worked from in all of my work. And I continued that idea of the sort of the tissue flat pattern, mm-hmm. you know, sort of continues into the Japanese lantern work right. as well. So, and it yeah. wasn't really, you know, it wasn't a conscious thing of like, oh, I'm going to kind of go back to my roots and use this and have this sort of female way of working be, you know, be something that's a part of the work. It's just how I worked.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's just how I knew yeah. how to put things together. So
I totally get that, because when I made this large sculpture mother tree, and I had been making the lantern forms much smaller scale, though, you know, just like 1 foot orbs. And I wanted to make this giant paper dress. And I didn't sew extensively, but I did sew as a child and in high school. And I finally realized I could merge the two. Yeah. I could just yeah. make a pattern for a panel, which is the same thing I was doing with the lantern forms, mm-hmm. and then put them together like a dress. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually behind me in it, right up there, are uh-huh. all of the, I still have all the patterns. When I would get done, right. I would fold them up just like a dress mm-hmm. pattern. I'd put them in an envelope and I'd label yeah. the envelope.
Yeah.
You know, they're all there.
Cool. You're very organized. Mine are like strewn about. I find them every so often. Oh, that's where that is.
Well, I have to be physically organized because mentally I'm really disorganized.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to make sure that you know about my how-to books about papermaking and paper crafts. My latest book is called The Art of Papercraft, and it offers a rich variety of projects that will delight crafters, artists, and designers alike, including paper votive lights, pop-up cards, folded paper gift boxes and envelopes, woven paper wall hangings, miniature one-sheet books, and much more. I also have two popular books about papermaking: Papermaking with Garden Plants and Common Weeds, and The Papermaker's Companion. All three books are available on Kindle. Now back to our conversation.
You've done so many bodies of work. I'm curious how you move from one thing to the next.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think it's kind of a liability. I've moved a lot, and mm-hmm. I seem to change my work radically every 5 years, and it makes it difficult to you know, to market my work or to, you know, to approach galleries, because who knows what I'll be doing in 5 years. So mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's not entirely a good thing, but yeah, about every 5 years, except I did the welded paper for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But when I quit doing that, it's like every 5 years I do something totally different. I don't know why. But the work that I think it was around the mid 90s, especially when I started teaching high school, my career, teaching career, is so backwards. You know, I started with, you know, grad school,
right?
Ring a grad program and undergrad program. And then I moved to just an undergrad program, and then I moved to high school. So,
and which high school near Boston?
I taught it at Andover.
Okay.
Phillips Academy, Andover, yeah. Andover, Massachusetts. And it's a, you know, it's a really good school, and it was, I think compared to a lot of high schools, it was a lot like teaching at the university level, except the students were
younger,
15, 16, and 17. Yeah. And there were some research opportunities, and there were some sabbatical opportunities, not like at the college level, but there was some of that. Mm-hmm. There was a gallery, you know, we ran a gallery. Mm-hmm. And we were right next door to the Addison Gallery of American Art, which was yeah. amazing, you know, yeah. to have that right there. But when I started teaching at the high school level, my assignments had to be a lot more, especially for the general classes that were not for the art kids necessarily. There were some required general art classes for all the kids. And I had to make the assignments in a way that on the one hand left room for creative process and for students to do what they wanted. But they also had to be sort of tight enough that the students didn't feel threatened, mm-hmm. you know, that they didn't feel or overwhelmed right. or lost.
Yeah.
You know, and so I had to do a lot more when I would come up with a new assignment. I really had to make examples you know, mm-hmm. sort of Julia Child fashion, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, this is what it looks like at this point. This is how it is before it goes in the oven. This is, you know, what it looks like when it comes out of the oven, those kinds of things. And when I would do those, when I would do those examples, you know, when I was onto a good assignment, then I wanted to do it too, mm-hmm. you know? And so that was a big, so my teaching started to really influence my work. My work, I think, always influenced my teaching, but it started to go move the other direction when I was, you know, like mid-career in my teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the tunnel studies pieces that I started doing those, I was inspired to do those after doing several examples for a tunnel book assignment.
Ah, okay.
No, so that's...
Yeah.
That's where that started.
And you were you teaching a general art course?
I think the tunnel books I think may have been. I taught a general 3D studio class.
Okay.
It was a required class at the ninth grade level, which was really fun. I really enjoyed teaching that. And I mean, I enjoyed all my classes. Mm-hmm. But I taught that, and then I taught some more kind of mid-level classes, more sculpture and then weaving. And it was sculpture and papermaking actually, and then a weaving class. And then I taught the advanced senior studio class. It was a year-long class for the kids who, you know, might be going on to art school, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
I taught that too.
Right.
So
that sounds like a great environment. Were you the only art teacher? Were there other art teachers?
No, it was for a high school, it was a pretty good sized department. I think there were 8 or 9 of us.
Oh, wow. That's
so
cool.
I mean, they had better, you know, people. I'd have visiting artists come from, you know, different university environments, and they would come and look around with eyes wide open, like, oh my God.
Yeah.
We had 2 dark rooms and really good digital facility. With support,
yeah, you know,
people worked there,
right?
Then I had a really good budget, so you know, I was able to get the equipment that I wanted. I didn't have a beater, I purposely didn't get a beater. We used Japanese technique, uh-huh. Uh-huh. We did hand beading,
right.
Of Kozo fiber mostly. But it was we had a really nice facility, and I had a lot of freedom to teach what I wanted to teach,
yeah.
So
right, that sounds great. So describe this tunnel series. I had no idea it was related to the tunnel book, but now that you say that, I can totally see windows in your work, and I'll post a picture.
So it was 2 assignments. There was the tunnel book assignment, and then I had another assignment that I used for a long time that was really popular with the kids, and it was essentially a sort of a layer. It was a photo assignment where it was abstraction, and the students were to go take photographs. This is just really general. There's more to it, but go take photographs, and then we'd go up to the lab, and they could, you know, colorize the photographs, liquefy them, do, you know, all kind of, use all the toys in Photoshop. You know, just mm-hmm. pull out all the stops and just use all the mm-hmm. toys in Photoshop. And then print all these images out on the color laser printer. And then they would cut those up and layer them and have the finished piece be a reflection or interpretation of a piece of music that they had chosen.
Oh,
it was really popular.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I had kids doing, you know, classical music, and kids doing Radiohead, and kids doing Motown, and kids doing stuff I never heard of, and, you know, bubblegum pop music. And, you know, it had to be, I think one requirement is the music couldn't have words.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Because I wanted them to really focus on the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that assignment. And then I think I did a tunnel book project with the advanced students. And it was those 2 things together that I started on the tunnel books myself. And I was interested in the idea of landscape photography, or sort of landscape in general, where when you're standing in front of a landscape painting or a landscape photograph, and you're just sort of taking the whole thing in as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're standing in front of, when you're out in the woods and you're looking into the woods, it's a totally, your eyes and your brain are doing a totally different thing. You're trying to see around the trees, to see that lake that's behind the trees, the, you know, your view of the clouds might be blocked. You're trying to see things and you're kind of moving back and forth. You're kind of standing, you know, swaying back and forth, trying to see what's behind everything. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get that. I wanted to see if I could capture that in a static work.
Right.
A physically static work of art. And so I just started cutting holes in the photographs and layering them together to see if I could, to see if I could get that.
Mm-hmm. And you were you scanning and printing, or how are you getting the photographs onto what material?
Oh, you know, at this point, the technology had come along far enough that I had a pretty nice digital camera. Mm-hmm. So I was taking photographs, and then I had access to really good cameras at school. Mm-hmm. So I was taking photographs and then printing them out on inkjet printers that the school had. And I was printing them out, I think, just on like Stonehenge and BFK, you know, mm-hmm. kind of printmaking mm-hmm. papers. Mm-hmm. And there was a little color shift, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So I was working there, and then I got a grant through Andover to do some work at the museum school. And they had a large format iris printer.
Okay.
And so I worked with Matt Gamber there, and we were doing things. I think they were like 3 by 4 feet. Mm-hmm. They were big. And in retrospect, after I got those things printed, I realized I really should have gone a little smaller. But I was doing some really big pieces with the oval cutouts, and the oval cutouts started. I started doing those oval cutouts when I had a postcard, you know, the bed project, which you're going to post a photo mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. The bed project, if you look at the image, you can see all the little ellipses of the open tops of all of the Japanese lantern forms.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just playing around with collage, I think maybe even a tunnel book, and I cut out all those little ellipses that were the tops of all those forms, and then put a different photograph behind it.
Ah. Right.
And that's where the ellipse thing happened as well. And I was making tunnel books to show kids, and I just had postcards from the show. And I'll just start
right.
Cutting.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's where, and I like the ellipse because the ellipse has this sort of perspective, you know, as mm-hmm. though you're seeing a circle, you know,
right.
on
right.
a side kind of. Yeah. So I like that.
Yeah. And in the tunnel studies, were you hand cutting the ellipses, or did you use some kind of
I used a Fiskars shape cutter.
Okay.
And then at this point I didn't have access to a laser cutter, so I found a company online and I sent them my I did some ellipse shapes in Illustrator mm-hmm. and I sent the files to a laser company and to get my own ellipses cut for the project. It's like a stencil.
Right. So I thought the ellipses were cut into your larger sheets, but is
they
that...
are. Yeah, they are. Okay. Yeah.
So you had those, you sent those to so this I sent company.
I did the actual cutting. I can post it.
Okay.
I have this little gadget. That's
okay,
a,
that it's like, made it easy to cut an ellipse.
Yeah, it's a swivel. It's essentially a swivel, a swiveling X-Acto blade.
Right.
In a little handheld thing. And then you use it with, it's almost like a spirograph. And you use it with plastic jigs, plastic.
Got it.
Yeah. Or guides. And so then you use the circle cutter inside this little jig, just like you're doing spirograph.
Right. Yep. Okay.
And it cuts it out. So I had the Fiskars templates were okay, but they were very limiting. Mm-hmm. And then I also made templates by just taking architectural I don't know what this stuff is even called.
Yeah, those things with the different shapes in them.
The green things with all the circles in them.
Yeah.
So I had a bunch of those and I was able to use those as well. I still have them. I glued little strips of balsa wood between the circles on those to get the whole thing up off the, make it a little thicker.
Uh-huh.
So I used those and then I had the ones that I had made
with this
wacky little Fiskars cutter.
Yeah. Oh, love it. All right. I want to talk about two more bodies of work. So paper iterations. Tell me about that. And what's the material? And it's inkjet printed, but then you cut so much away. I'm just curious about that. And again, listeners, you'll have to go look at a picture to see what we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, are you talking about because I had a few different iteration series. Is this the one?
You had some big hanging ones and then you used the cutouts for a second piece.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So the big one that started out, that was supposed to be all, I did the tunnel studies and then I wanted to sort of push it and see how much can I cut away? How much of the image can I cut away and still have something that the viewer can sort of connect to in terms of the imagery. And I wound up with those pieces. I was still using the photographic, photo-based imagery. I don't know, just, you know, flowers and woodlands and different things. And then on the backside, I was printing images, line drawings of trees, outlines of trees. Mm-hmm. And so I was cutting them from the back and cutting out sort of the tree branches. Because I had just been collecting a lot of images of branches in Andover in the winter. There were just so many beautiful elm trees. They still have elms there. Beautiful elm trees and sycamores and maples and beech and just all kinds of beautiful trees on the campus. And then of course in the winter they're just they're bare branches, but they're gorgeous. And I just I would think. There was such a comparison, and my mother had Alzheimer's, and it was such a comparison between sort of the brain, sort of the brain, it's kind of the branching of the brain and thought process, and then the branching of the, the tree branches, and there's just so much there, and so powerful. And so I took so many pictures of trees with no leaves on them, and then I used those in Photoshop. I would transform this so it was just the edges, the find edges tool in Photoshop, to make essentially drawings of the, or they looked like drawings of the tree branches, and then I'd print those and cut out all the negative spaces in those.
Right, so you're left with just a giant paper cut with large openings, fairly large.
And it's possible that also, the teaching may have also played into that as well, because my main classroom was, one window was all glass, and right outside that glass was just a magnificent, huge maple tree. And one of the first assignments in the first day of class, I've got kids drawing what's not there. And they're looking at that maple tree and drawing the spaces between and then sort of winding up with a tree. So there might have been an element there too of cutting out all of the spaces. And I was going to layer the iterations piece. I was going to layer all of those together. Mm-hmm. They're all about, I don't know, like 14 by 18 inches. Mm-hmm. And I was going to layer them all. And then I did a few layered pieces, which I still have, but I don't know. They just weren't, it wasn't doing what I wanted it to. And so that I found that if I put them together in a grid, more sort of quilt fashion, like quilt square fashion, that I thought that was way more interesting. And then the shadows that it cast.
Mm-hmm. So they're hung on the wall, a little off the wall.
Yeah, it's hung. Yeah. I made some brackets. It's about 4 inches off the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I that's actually the second iteration of that piece. It started out as layered pieces, and I actually took all the pieces apart. And then reassembled them into a group. Uh-huh. And then I had all those leftovers. And in a way, I was doing this, and it was like, what a waste of ink, you know? Because I'd print out these very colorful, saturated things, and then I was cutting most of it away.
Right.
Inkjet ink is like the most expensive liquid on the planet, you know? And it's like, so as, you know, and as artists do, I saved all those pieces.
Right. And these were like maybe 3 by 5 inches. Something like that.
The biggest ones were 3 by 5 inches. A lot of the pieces were maybe, I would say maybe 2 by 3 inches at the biggest. A lot of them were just like 1 by 2 inches.
They okay.
were small. Yeah. Uh-huh. So then I had all those left over. And that's when I started. And this, I think I have a little description on my website.
Yes, you do.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully that makes sense. I'm not sure it does, but I took all the smaller pieces and then cut them into concentric circles. So one piece, one of those negative space cutouts would wind up being maybe six mm-hmm. concentric rings. And then I would take those and then arrange those together and glue them together. And it was just, I mean, it was like the golden mean.
Yeah.
End up with these seashell things and these things that just really look like, you know, something that you found on the beach, you know, these kind of oceanic kinds of things. And again, getting back to that, you know, the natural, the world that grows versus the world that's built.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And they're built, but boy, they sure look like they just grew.
You know? Right.
So that was a lot of fun. And I think I did, I did maybe 100 or so of those, which turned into another piece. Installation.
Right. You display them all together on the wall. Yeah, I love that piece.
There might be a photograph on the website, but that was really hard to photograph because the shadows make it look like it's out of something.
Yeah, I noticed you said they look out of focus because of the shadows. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Did you turn to paper weaving next? Or you've done other things, but let's talk about your paper weavings because.
Okay. I did a series of paintings on old books before the weaving. And that started because the library at Andover was deaccessioning an alarming number of books. They were getting rid of books and making space for maker spaces and all that kind of stuff. And the books they were throwing away, they weren't worth any money, mm-hmm. but it was astounding the number of books that were just getting tossed. And so I was actually doing assignments with my sculpture class and my advanced classes using old books. Mm-hmm. And so we would just like a parade. We'd all walk over to the library and go through their big trash cans. And every student would walk back to the art building with as many books as they could carry.
Uh-huh.
And so we had stacks and stacks and stacks of old books.
Right.
And so the students were working with old books. I was working with old books. And so that's where the altered book stuff started, was just because of the library, just because it was there. It was a material that was available. And then the weaving started when I was teaching remotely. And it was in March. It was a spring trimester class. So I never saw the students even once in person.
This was 2020?
This was 2020.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because everything shut down in March.
March, yeah.
Yeah, because John and I were supposed to go to New York for a weekend. And I thought I was being really wimpy and I canceled it. And we would have been there when they shut down Broadway.
Right.
Wow. And we would have had to take a bus back to Andover.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, people that we knew that went back and forth to Boston and New York were getting COVID.
Yeah.
I don't know if they knew it was COVID then, but people were getting really sick.
Right.
And so I had to teach a weaving class remotely.
So had you already been teaching traditional weaving or paper weaving prior to that?
Yeah. Yeah. I taught, at Andover, even at Appalachian State as well. I taught a level one weaving class.
Mm-hmm.
Where the students used rigid frame looms, and we did card weaving. Actually, at Andover, I used deaccession climbing equipment for backstrap looms for card weaving.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught students, they did some hand weaving, they did tapestries and We did some indigo dyeing and that kind of thing. And then the students had the opportunity, they didn't have to, but they had the opportunity to do some overshot pattern weaving on floral looms.
And tell me what overshot, what does that mean?
Overshot just means threads that are going over the top of the fabric.
Okay. So yeah. Hanging off. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the threads that are kind of, that are slightly above are the ones that are making the pattern. So there's a plain weave that is sort of the matrix. Mm-hmm. And then there are these overshot threads.
Right.
They're shooting over the plain weave and then back over and under the plain weave, which are making the pattern.
Right.
Okay. So the students had the opportunity to do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And for teaching online, the students were all in there at home. Some of them, they weren't even at home. Their New York parents had taken them to apartments, who knows where. You know, so students were really either displaced or they were stuck.
Right.
And I had to teach a weaving class, and I didn't want it to just be, you know, sort of a history class, you know, or, you know, a crit class. So I had to start trying things as well. So I was weaving on using cardboard and cutting slits in it and warping, doing warps on cardboard, and also doing just drawing weaving. I started with Annie Albers sketchbooks and had students just drawing, making drawings that were weavings. And then from there, working on cardboard looms and weaving, using whatever they could find for weft material. You know, students were using all kinds of stuff.
Right.
Some cases just cutting, you know, cutting up clothes they didn't like, or, you know, using shopping bags or, you know, whatever they could find.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had students do an assignment with text as well, because text is pretty easy to find at home. Mm-hmm. You can find something that's got text and cut up. And so I had them doing that. And so each of these things that I did, I had to do it too. I had to do it first to make sure it would work and to figure out how to present it and how to teach it. Mm-hmm. And I had to make all of the videos for the demonstrations, which you know how much work that is. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
But in the process of doing all of that, I actually got interested in these pieces. And I had been wanting to weave again for a long time. I taught weaving for years, and I hadn't woven since, you know, I hadn't woven myself to make something myself that I wanted to weave since like 1991 was the last time I'd really woven anything, except for teaching it. And so I was interested in getting back into it. And I'd make some frame looms sometimes and try a few things and set them aside and, you know, couldn't get it to work. But I got interested again, especially in the woven text, when I was coming up with assignments for the students. And then, you know, it was COVID, so you're just kind of at home. And so I started working with the text myself as well. And also working with a lot of leftover photo materials that were on Japanese paper.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had a lot of that lying around from all the, you know, the tunnel study projects and from all the projects. I don't throw any of that stuff away. I have piles and piles of it. So I was using that stuff, and then all the piles of old books at school, you know, so that's where that started. And at this point, the work has gotten to be large enough scale, and I'm a little concerned about copyright, that I've actually started. I don't like it as well. I don't like doing it as well. I prefer cutting up the old books directly and gluing the strips together to make longer strips.
Uh-huh.
But I have started getting text from Gutenberg.org.
Mm-hmm.
And actually using the inkjet printer to make big sheets of text that I can cut out. So I don't have the problem of possible copyright issues.
Gutenberg.org is copyright free.
Mm-hmm.
That's why
everything on Gutenberg.org is in the public domain.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've started doing that. So I'm not working at this moment. I'm not working with the actual altered books. So,
okay. So you started with the altered books and your imagery.
Yeah.
And, yes, listeners, you have to go to the show notes page and look at Teresa's weavings. They are very unique. And talk about these patterns that you're using. And you've got a couple of recommendations for programs and tools.
Yeah, so when I started doing these weavings and I was just experimenting, I was doing them all just in plain weave and then simple twills, which, you know, being a weaver, I could do a twill without looking at anything, you know. And then I quickly started getting interested in the idea of sort of the labyrinth and also that idea. I've been listening to and reading a lot of books about, you know, on climate change and trees and reading, you know, they're not obscure books. They're books that a lot of people are reading.
Yeah.
You know, The Hidden Life of Trees, Looking for the Mother Tree. Mm-hmm. And so I was interested in that idea of the web, you know, the sort of underground web. And so I like the idea of sort of a labyrinth pattern to sort of be that web. Not that the weaving on its own isn't a web, it is. And I discovered the I think it's handweaving.net.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually subscribed. So there's a yearly subscription fee. It's not a lot.
Right.
And so I have access to all of those patterns that I can alter. They've also got editing materials. You can edit them. And then, you know, then I import a lot of them into this iWeaveIt app. Like, I think it's $25 for an iPad, and edit some more. And then I take screenshots, and then I import the screenshots into Photoshop, and then I edit some more in order to get, you know, the final pattern that I can use for weaving the pieces. And in a way, and then when I go to weave the piece, sort of everything is done and I just have to weave it, which I would like to figure out a way to make the process a little messier and a little more where there's some room for some improvisation in the process of weaving it. And I'm not there yet. I keep trying and then I keep kind of, reverting back to the actual finished pattern. It's hard to get away with weaving. It's hard to get away from that.
Yeah, it's almost, weaving is so, it's a huge field. I mean, there's so many, I'm trying to visualize what you're saying, and I've done a lot of paper weaving, but I come at it from a total just weaving pieces of paper together and then cutting between the layers and doing curves. And I have not followed weaving patterns very much at all.
Right.
So it's really interesting. It'd be interesting to get together in a room and
it'd be interesting to collaborate
ideas or collaborate. Yeah, we should. So I'm curious what you're saying. So you're doing all this work in iWeaveIt and then in Photoshop. And then are you actually printing out what you came up with into two documents that you're cutting? Is that from?
No, I'm cutting. It's so hard to just talk about.
Okay.
I'm actually when I print the images that I use for the weavings, I actually print cutting guides right on the paper.
Okay. Oh, so you're not cutting straight strips.
I am cutting straight strips.
Oh, you are. Okay.
Yeah, but the guides for cutting those strips is printed right on the paper.
Yeah,
for cutting those out. And let's see. And then the pattern that I've made in Photoshop, I never print it. It stays on my computer.
Okay.
And then I work from my computer because I'll have the numbers of all of the weft threads in a layer and I can keep moving that layer.
Right.
So I'm sure this makes no sense.
Yeah. Yeah. We won't go into detail. And I have no traditional loom weaving experience. So
yeah,
I look at those patterns and I'm meeting with someone because I'm writing a book about paper weaving. So I'm meeting with someone soon to show me how to read those because I can't quite grasp that.
Yeah. You know, And it's always fun to teach students how to read those because it's code.
Yeah. Right.
It's code. And looms were sort of the first early computers.
Yeah.
The Jaguar. That's one way that I got boys to take my weaving class.
Ah, interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
And maybe some girls too, who were also coders.
Yeah.
But it is, and it's also it's like music. It's like a musical staff. Mm-hmm. So it's very simple, but if you don't know, if you don't know how to read music.
Right.
Well, it doesn't, that notation is not going to mean anything. So it's, yeah. once this, I'll be curious, this person is going to show it to you. It's essentially the pattern is essentially like a bird's eye view of a loom.
Right.
This is what it is, you know, you'll be surprised. So it's so easy.
I've done graph paper drawings. So yeah, I just have to make that connection. And this person has taken my paper weaving class several times. Okay. So I think she's a good fit for showing me.
Yeah. That'll be good. Yeah. The thing about handweaving.net, and that's true. If you're not a weaver, I don't know how much you could actually use it as a resource for weaving paper. I think it almost, I don't know.
Yeah, you should definitely look at it though, listeners, because I do see pattern. I can see how it would be useful. I can visualize in paper.
Yeah, I guess one recommendation that I would make, if you want to use that website for pattern, and in order to get it to make sense as you're looking at it, is change the colors. So you want the warp threads, the vertical threads, to be, let's say, change the white to off-white. And mm-hmm. change the red to orange. Mm-hmm. And then you'll be able to see which is a vertical thread and which is a horizontal thread. And you can't tell by just looking at the pattern the way it is, because the vertical is red and white and the horizontal is red and white.
Oh, yeah. That's so
if you change two of those, you can see it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And you also recommended the Notability app.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Notability is just, it's a note-taking app that you can get. I have an iPad, so I don't know about, Android. And it's, I've used it since I got my first iPad, who knows whenever this came out. Mm-hmm. Our school was all into technology and everyone got iPads. And so we had a little iPad users group and things. And we discovered this Notability note-taking tool, which is very versatile. It's quite simple, but it's versatile. You can, if you take photos with your phone, you can pop them in really easily. You can use either a stylus or an Apple Pencil to draw on top of the photographs or next to the photographs and take notes. It's in a page sort of format. So it's essentially a way to do sketchbooks. And I really like it because you can try things in different stages. You know, you can take a photograph of something that you're in the middle of and put it on your iPad. And it's like, well, what if I changed the background to this? Or what if I cut this up? Or what if, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, you can't do as much as in Photoshop, which is good because then you don't get sucked into it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's simple enough. You don't go down a rabbit hole with a sketchbook. You know, it stays kind of the useful tool that's not a time, you know, just doesn't take all your time.
Right. And then you actually print these out as sketchbooks?
Yeah, I could, I could probably put something online, but so like, here's a page.
Okay. Yeah.
So this, each page is a page in Notability. Mm-hmm. And then I just had, you know, I had the whole book printed out. And every time I get about 100 pages of Notability pages, then I just have one of these books printed out.
Oh, that's so cool.
It's nice to have the book because if I'm working on stuff, it's so nice to be able to just pick up the book.
Right.
And look, rather than getting my iPad out and then, oh, I have email, you know. It's
right.
That kind of stuff. So
yeah, I like that too. And you're using printing service like Lulu or Blur.
I'm using Lulu. I just chose Lulu. I also like it because even though my computer backs, the Notability app is not great, the backup isn't great. And so I mean I have everything backed up, but I still have this fear of losing everything. Mm-hmm. And so I like to have the hard copy, so I don't have to worry about what if it disappears, or what if I get a different computer, or what if iCloud explodes, or you know.
Yeah.
So I like to have the books. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool. And what are you working on right now?
I've been picking strawberries like crazy. You know, it's interesting when I taught full, because I'm retired from teaching now. Uh-huh. And when I taught full time, summer was my time to make art.
Mm-hmm.
And winter, I got some art made during the winter, but winter was when I taught. That's when I worked, you know,
right.
job. And now I'm finding it's flipping. So I'm finding that the, you know, the long winter days up here in Minnesota are really great for making art. And we have a big garden. We've got the cabin. And so right now it's that kind of stuff. And also I just got a new camera. I got a new OM1 digital camera that is so complicated. I'm still trying to, I'm still working on getting through the settings. I'm still learning to use it. I haven't actually started. Yeah. I'm still learning how to use it. So I've got that, and I'm going to keep doing the paper weavings, but I'm feeling a little, I'm not quite sure what to do next. I've done several of them, and I want to make a change.
Mm-hmm.
And I am trying to figure out what that change will be. And it might be something incremental. It might be something, you know, more major, mm-hmm. but while I'm out working in the garden, I am thinking about what am I going to do next? And, you know, being out there in the dirt, it, you know,
yeah.
kind of, well, what would I, if I had my big camera out here, what would I be taking photographs of and why would I be using them? And we're also at this point working on, and this does go back into the work, but our property up north has been just devastated by spruce budworm.
Mm.
And it's also, there was two summers ago, there was a big forest fire 30 miles from our cabin.
Mm.
And there's climate change and,
yeah.
it's, you know, and all of that, you know, I feel like, I think in the city, the climate change is mainly, you know, is weather. And then when you have property that is, more wilderness, although it's where we're at is exactly wilderness, but it's sort of unmanaged. You live it every day,
right.
You know, in terms of fire danger, in terms of, you know, watching the trees just die, you know, mm-hmm. all around. And so we just had our property, cleared of all of this, the dead spruce and the sick spruce and the balsam.
For fire management.
Yeah. So instead of applying for artist grants, I'm applying for land management grants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which plays right into the work I'm doing. The texts that I'm using are Rachel Carson and, mm-hmm. you know, John Muir. And so it plays right into that. So, you know, been working on getting that done. This spring, we're going to plant 400 trees, shrubs up there, and then try and take care of them so they don't all die.
Right.
No?
Yeah. That's a huge job.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's all going to find its way back into the work.
Right. And are you showing your weavings at all?
No.
Okay.
So I would like, teaching high school for almost 20 years, you know, I sort of got out of the loop.
Yeah.
When I taught at the college level, teaching it, I don't really realize how much the connections at the college level, how valuable they are until you don't have them.
Yeah.
So I've been teaching high school, and I've been showing some in Boston. I showed some in Boston,
mm-hmm.
And you know, at our gallery at school, and I had a big studio in Lawrence, and then moving to St. Paul, it's a lot harder to make new connections, you know, when you're in your 60s than when you're in your 20s and 30s.
Right. Yeah.
So it's going to take a while to figure out, you know, to kind of get the work out. And plus, the first year and a half we were here, it was COVID.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, we're just, you know, just in the last 6 months, we really started going out to galleries and stuff again.
Yeah.
But it is a little odd to be making work and not having any shows lined up,
mm-hmm.
because I'm practical enough that I like to be working towards, an exhibition that is actually going to happen. So that's something that I need to work on.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's a lot of different hats we wear as artists, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like when I'm in the studio, I should be working on promoting my work, and when I'm working on trying to promote it, I should be in the studio. So,
yeah. Right. Okay. Well, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. And where can we find you online, Therese?
I have my website, teresazemlin.com, and I'm on Instagram. I'm not really active on Instagram. I don't know how to,
how to say, is it at Therese Zemlin? Is it just your name? I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. If you want to do that, it's, yeah. I'll have to look. I really don't use it that much, but I do post works of art. I try and use Instagram mainly for studio stuff.
Right.
So, but yeah, we can figure it out.
Yeah. 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 And listeners, you just go to HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast and look for the episode with Therese Zemlin and you'll find the show notes. Okay, great. Thanks so much, Therese. It's been really fun talking to you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at HelenHebertStudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert's studio. You can find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon. There's a reason besides the season, the make it take.